Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief, and an especially big welcome to our listeners on KTLK AM 1150 in Los Angeles. I'm Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, and we're broadcasting this week from the television capital of the world, Burbank, California. Today, as the first court martial related to the Abu Ghraib prison scandal gets underway, we'll hear from an Army reservist who turned in his weapon and was granted conscientious objector status after working at that prison. Also today, before the next president is elected, don't be surprised if you hear a lot more questions like this one.
To understand each candidate's view of a personal God. Do they believe that through the power of prayer, disasters like Hurricane Katrina or the Minnesota bridge collapse could have been prevented or lessened?
What's the best way for candidates to handle these personal questions of faith? And is there any benefit to answering them at all? Plus, we'll look at a campaign race in Louisiana that's gotten downright dirty, with religion being used as the main weapon. But first, we want to get a little more acclimated to our surroundings. I remember someone telling me once that Los Angeles, despite not having a professional football team for many years, is the best football city in America. Instead of being a city that's dominated by geographical loyalty for a particular team, this person said, Los Angeles is home to citizens with roots all over the country. So on any given Sunday, you can expect to be watching a football game sitting next to an Eagles fan, a Giants fan, and a Redskins fan, all enjoying, say, the Bears beating up on the Cowboys. It turns the Sunday ritual of football into a celebration of the whole rather than of the individual. Similarly, the city has embraced diverse thought and identity when it comes to religion. It's home to more than 100 Christian denominations, the third largest population of Jews in America, the country's largest concentration of Buddhists, and dense communities representing faith traditions as old as Hinduism and as modern as transcendental meditation. One of my sociology of religion friends here says there are so many new religions arising in this area that he simply can't track all of them. So how did it all come to be? And what's the glue that holds it all together? Raphael Sonnenschein is a political scientist at Cal State Fullerton and is the author of Politics in Black and White, Race and Power in Los Angeles. He caught our attention last month with an opinion piece in the LA Times entitled The City of Sectarian Angels, and he joins us now from his home in Santa Monica. Raphael Sonnenschein, welcome to State of Belief.
Good to be with you.
Now, you've tracked three different eras of religion in talking about religion as a political force in Los Angeles. Who were the power brokers during each one of them?
Well, the origin of the city of Los Angeles is really Catholic, in that it was settled by people, settlers from the Empire of Spain who were living in Mexico, who came to this area of Southern California and eventually established a whole network of missions. And much of the early influence of Los Angeles, therefore, is traditionally Catholic. And then in the late 1800s, there was a huge migration to Los Angeles from the Midwest of the United States and parts of the South of people who were largely Protestant, and they were actually quite conservative in many ways. They were seeking their fortune out on the West Coast. And within a matter of a few decades, the Catholic influence, and including the Hispanic influence of Los Angeles, was really undercut by the rise of this group of white Protestant Midwesterners who had this vision that Los Angeles would be like a little Midwestern town, but it would have all the virtues of a great city. And that really was Los Angeles for the first half of the 20th century. It was a city whose power structure was largely white Protestant, very strongly influenced by business. And they had a pretty significant control in elections, and it was minority groups were pretty quiet during during the first half of the 20th century. And then when that conservative bloc was overturned, not by a new religious force necessarily, but by African Americans, who were themselves largely Protestant, in alliance with another group, which is the Jewish vote in Los Angeles, which was very liberal. And that coalition behind Mayor Tom Bradley ran the city for 20 years and was very dominant. And now what do we have with the rise of immigration again, especially Latino immigration to Los Angeles? We have a resurgence of a Catholic presence in Los Angeles coming through the new migrants from the southern area of the Western Hemisphere coming into Los Angeles. This becomes a whole new era. It's yet another sort of religious transition in Los Angeles, overlapping with all kinds of racial and ethnic transitions.
Raphael, one of the things that I found interesting about your writing is the contrast between what you are saying about a political renaissance of Catholicism in the city and the comments that actually we've reported on State of Belief in recent weeks from some Catholic leaders on the East Coast who think that Roman Catholicism is getting a bad rap these days and is somewhat under siege. If you move beyond what everybody sees, the externals, what do you see going on internally, politically, that documents this political renaissance of Catholicism in Los Angeles?
Well, that's really why I wrote the article, partly because with all the issues about scandals involving child abuse that the L.A. Archdiocese has been dealing with and that have really dominated the headlines, it struck me that people were missing what's happening under the surface, which is that the Catholic Church is being revived, not just in Los Angeles, but in many cases worldwide, through what's going on in Latin America and Africa and in other countries that haven't really been seen as central. The future is probably going to be with the mixture of ethnicity and excitement and interest coming from working class people who are immigrating to the United States, but also even in their own countries. We hear a lot from the East Coast about the church, and in truth, back on the East Coast, the heyday of the political power of the Catholic Church was decades ago. In the 1920s through the 1950s in the big East Coast cities where they had overthrown the Protestant establishment, decades before that. But they in turn have become kind of conservative and sort of quiet and not really at the forefront of social change. And I think out here is a completely different setting where after these current scandals pass, and I'm not minimizing these scandals, but I'm saying that there's going to be new leadership coming up. I visualize in the article what happens if someday there's a dynamic Latino cardinal appointed in Los Angeles. How big would that be? I don't even have to tell you how big that would be. That would be a huge development.
Raphael, let me ask you, there is vast religious diversity in Los Angeles. What about the minority religious traditions? Are they factoring into the city's political landscape at all?
Well, again, having lived on both sides of this country, the diversity in religion is like the diversity of everything else in Los Angeles. There isn't going to be statements issued by the Catholic hierarchy about how politicians should act and have anybody expect them to actually be carried out. No one's going to take orders from any church. So I think what it really has to do with is more that the Catholic Church out here is going to have to allow 1,000 voices to bloom in order to be big. And my guess is that they will find that a very good trade-off. It's going to be a different kind of religion out here because everybody, the Jews are diverse out here, the Protestants are diverse out here, and that's only these three main religions. People are free to go their own way in their personal practices.
Raphael Sonnenschein, professor at Cal State Fullerton, author of Politics in Black and White, Race and Power in Los Angeles. Thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
It's a pleasure to join you.
Still to come, staying true to one's faith when confronted with the horrors of war. And up next, the question that simply won't go away in the presidential debates.
Do they believe that through the power of prayer, disasters like Hurricane Katrina or the Minnesota bridge collapse could have been prevented or lessened?
I'm Welton Gaddy, and you're listening to State of Belief on Air America Radio. I love LA. Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Getty, coming to you from Los Angeles, California, Burbank, to be exact. Just last week, you may remember, we gave a green light in our Intersection Awards to Rudy Giuliani for his answer to a question that he received while campaigning in Iowa. Giuliani was asked about being a good Catholic, and he responded that his faith is a private matter, and whether he's a good Catholic or not is an issue between himself and his priest. Well, that's a very well-reasoned answer to a question that skirts the line of having a religious test for public office. But we also pointed out that many of the presidential candidates on the campaign trail are actually trying to have it both ways when it comes to the faith question. They say they want to keep it private, but then they'll pepper their campaign appearances with comments about their strong Christian values. Well, after last Sunday's Democratic presidential debate on ABC, we're left wondering if these candidates can ever expect to leave the issue of personal faith aside. Here's a question that was sent in by a man from Utah. It's being read here by the debate moderator, George Stephanopoulos.
To understand each candidate's view of a personal God. Do they believe that through the power of prayer, disasters like Hurricane Katrina or the Minnesota bridge collapse could have been prevented or lessened?
Now, remember, this is a question in a political debate, not a question posed to religious leaders graduating with PhDs in religion. Listen also to some of the answers by the candidates.
Well, I don't pretend to understand the wisdom and the power of God. I do believe in prayer, and I have relied on prayer consistently throughout my life.
I think there are some things that are beyond our control, and I think it is enormously important to look to God, and in my case, Christ, for guidance and for wisdom. But I don't think you can prevent bad things from happening through prayer.
The answer to the gentleman's question is no. All the prayer in the world will not stop a hurricane. But prayer will give you the courage to be able to respond to the devastation that's caused in your life and with others to deal with the devastation.
I'm a Roman Catholic. My sense of social justice, I believe, comes from being a Roman Catholic. But in my judgment, prayer is personal. And how I pray and how any American prays, for what reason, is their own decision, and it should be respected. And so, in my view, I think it's important that we have faith, that we have values, but if I'm president, I'm not going to wear my religion on my sleeve and impose it on anybody.
Well, good for Bill Richardson. Joining us on the phone right now is Dan Neifelt. Dan's with the organization Faith in Public Life, and he blogged about this part of the debate on the Faith in Public Life website. Dan, thanks for being with us on State of Belief.
Thank you.
Now, what about these candidates' answers struck you most?
Personally, what struck me was the lack of candor by some of the candidates and some of the great candor by a couple of the others, specifically Joe Biden and John Edwards, who came out and answered the question very straightforwardly by saying no, that they did not think that prayer could avert natural disasters. I mean, from other candidates, there was a little bit of equivocation and I don't want to say a dodge, but an indirect answer to the question. So it was interesting to me how different people took such different tacks.
Dan, do you ever, in listening to one of these, when one of those questions comes up, do you ever wish the candidates would just say that's none of your business?
Well, interesting that you mentioned that, because I was also very impressed with Bill Richardson's answer, which in essence was not it's none of your business, but that's private, that's personal. And I think that is a perfectly legitimate response to what is also a perfectly legitimate question.
Now, I know that at Faith in Public Life, you all have been getting a lot of questions, mainly from reporters, along the lines of what is it that religious voters want to hear from these candidates? Do you think this question from the debate is the exception or is it the rule, and will it have any impact on how people vote?
I really couldn't say whether it would have any impact on the way people will vote, but I think if you look at the way that these early campaigns are being covered in the media, that you are going to start to see more and more personal questions about people's faith, and their responses will kind of dictate the way these things go. I mean, this is an emerging trend, but if there's a certain line of questioning that is going to lead to a lot of answers along the lines of that's private, then you'll see those go by the wayside.
Why is it that people are focusing more on private matters of faith than on how faith informs policy?
I think it's because people aren't electing platforms. They're electing other human beings, and they really want to get a sense of who these human beings are. Identity is a very significant component of political campaigns, and this is one manifestation of that, I think.
Well, there's a link to Dan's blog posting from Faith in Public Life at stateofbelief.com. You can go there and you can contribute to the conversation. Dan, thanks for being with us on State of Belief. We'll probably be talking again before this election's over.
Okay, I look forward to it. Thank you, Reverend.
We'd also like for you to share your thoughts with us. Do you think candidates should answer personal questions about their faith? As I just said to Dan, I wish candidates would sometimes just refuse to answer the questions, but I suppose they fear being misunderstood. What about you? Do you feel that way? Does the answer a candidate gives to one of these very private questions influence how you will vote? We want to know that from you. Send us an email at stateofbelief.com or call us at 212-871-8280. That's 212-871-8280. Up next, we'll find out how faith informed the position not of a presidential candidate, but of a United States soldier who requested and was granted conscientious objector status in Iraq. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio. I'm Welton Gaddy. For the first time since news of the Abu Ghraib prison abuse scandal broke 3 years ago, an officer faces a court-martial for abuse of prisoners. The case may shed light on whether the mistreatment of detainees at the Baghdad facility was, as we were told by the government, the acts of a bunch of bad apples, or if it represented a policy that was driven from the top levels of the United States military. One soldier witnessed abuses by the military in Abu Ghraib and other areas in Iraq, and on account of his faith, he laid down his weapon and asked for a discharge. Aiden Delgado has documented his time in Iraq and his return home in the Sutras of Abu Ghraib, Notes from a Conscientious Objector in Iraq. The book is available now, and Aiden joins us on the phone from Georgia. Aiden Delgado, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you've called your enlistment into the military naive. Why is that the case? Did you feel ambivalent from the very beginning?
No, you know, I wouldn't say that. I was talking about the sort of general naivete that I think affects all young men and all young people who enlist in the Army. Naive in the sense that, yes, clearly we know there's a possibility we may go to war, and intellectually we know what that means. But we don't have a good sense of the reality of war, and we certainly don't have a good sense of the gravity of the decisions we're making as 17, 18-year-olds. So in that respect, I think any 17 or 18-year-old who joins the Army is in some way being naive because they don't have the maturity and the life experience to make so dramatic a decision.
What did you see among your fellow soldiers? For example, what was their attitude about the war and what was their attitude toward Iraqi civilians?
Well, just speaking from purely my own experience, the vast majority of my unit were highly supportive of the war. They certainly favored going to Iraq. I think by and large they felt that what we were doing in Iraq was related to September 11th. I used to ask them, you know, guys, why are we here? And they would say, well, we're here to prevent another September 11th. So I think that was the space they were coming from and why they felt that we should be there and why they supported the war. Their attitude towards Iraqis changed dramatically. When they initially arrived, there was sort of that standoffishness of entering a new culture and meeting new people. But unfortunately, as time went on, I saw a lot of prejudice and anti-Arab, anti-Muslim sentiment beginning to arise in the unit. And that was very disturbing to me because, as you may know, I lived for 8 years in Cairo. I could speak Arabic. I was much more attuned to the Middle Eastern lifestyle. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of the rhetoric back home about Muslims and terrorism and they're all terrorists, they're out to get us, I think that had really affected the guys in my unit. When I was leaving Fort Stewart, Georgia, getting ready to deploy to the Middle East, I was having a conversation with one of my friends about the Middle East and Islam and Iraq. And this master sergeant turned to me, and I wasn't saying anything radical, and he turned to me and said, well, if you love them so much, you should go join Al-Qaeda. And I thought, wow, that's a bit of a shocking response. And then later on, the same person told me that Muslims and Islam were two different religions, and that Osama bin Laden was the head of Islam. And so this was coming from such a deep, fundamental ignorance about the situation, about the history, that really gave me pause. And I thought, my God, you know, people are going to war. They may have to make life or death decisions based on horribly faulty information like this.
Were these attitudes a big factor in your disillusionment about the war?
Yes, you know, I think they were. And I think that it's not as trivial as it sounds to say that the attitude of soldiers about Iraqis affected me. I think it contributes to a whole aura and a whole atmosphere, and that the racial slurs come first, and then it's the casual brutality, and then it's the serious brutality, like what happened at Abu Ghraib. And I think that was one of the turning points, because I had always, as a youth, I'd always thought of the American Army as the good guys, you know, the reluctant heroes, the people who don't want to fight but only do so when it's thrust upon them. And then when I was in the war zone and I saw the attitude of some of the guys becoming the opposite, becoming looking for a fight, enjoying a fight, wanting to start trouble, and that really disillusioned me about what I thought the Army was all about and what I thought being a citizen soldier was all about.
Aidan, what did happen when you were at Abu Ghraib?
Well, you know, everything happened, and I think that the American people, they think they've gotten the full story, but really all we've seen is the tip of the iceberg. I mean, those horrible, iconic photos of the prisoner in black standing on the box. As shocking as it was, I think it's really only a small part of the Abu Ghraib story. And I think the real story at Abu Ghraib is that the day-to-day brutality, the day-to-day casual violence in the aggregate had a much larger effect on the Iraqi society and Iraqi people. But also, something that most Americans don't know, that the vast majority of prisoners inside Abu Ghraib were totally innocent, i.e. they had been picked up by mistake and were being held by bureaucratic snafu, and they hadn't committed any crime. And those that had committed a crime overwhelmingly had committed petty nonviolent crimes like identity theft or public drunkenness. And I think that's one of the stories that hasn't come out about Abu Ghraib, is how, in addition to the brutality of it, how dramatic the injustice was.
What is day-to-day brutality?
Well, I would say the attitude of the prison guards towards their charges. And again, it began slowly and it escalated. First, it's sort of, you know, the kick, the punch, the pushing over. Then it culminated in things like the November 24th riot, when the prisoners were demonstrating against their living conditions. And I say demonstrating, I mean they had made banners and they were marching and chanting slogans, protesting against being kept in such terrible conditions. And the guards attempted to quell this demonstration, which had become unruly, with rubber bullets, and that didn't work. So then they fired on them with real bullets, and they shot 12 of them. They killed three immediately, and one died later of his wounds. And then members of my unit took the bodies of these prisoners who had been killed in the riot and desecrated them, took photos of them scooping out their brains with a plastic MRE spoon and, you know, other graphic images. So, I mean, again, this was a stark contrast to what I had imagined the U.S. Army doing. I mean, they had just shot unarmed prisoners behind barbed wire, and it was not the only time, certainly, that prisoners were injured or killed.
Did this attitude of treating the Iraqis so horribly come from the top?
You know, I can't say that it originated at the top, and I'm not going to say that it was ordered. I think what it was an attitude of active neglect, in the sense that the officers didn't take a hand in the day-to-day operations deliberately. And they sort of, while the cats are away, the mice will play kind of attitude, in that it's a wink and a nod. You know, we know what's going on, or we suspect what's going on, but if we're not actually there, then we don't have to stop it. And I think that's more the attitude that contributed to Abu Ghraib, rather than a direct go forth and do this to this person. And I think that attitude went all the way down the chain until everybody had plausible deniability and everyone can say, oh, I didn't know. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't me personally.
I'm talking with Aidan Delgado, who was at Abu Ghraib and who is describing for us some of what went on there and now his reactions to that. How is one granted conscientious objector status, and what did you personally have to do to receive it?
Conscientious objector status is a very long, difficult bureaucratic process, and it basically begins with a long statement of belief. It's almost an essay where you write about what you believe, how you came to believe it, what in your life demonstrates it. And then there's the sort of interview component where you are interviewed by a chaplain to see if you're kind of sincere, and then you're interviewed by a psychologist to test your mental health. And then it ultimately comes down to an interview with an investigating officer, that's a captain or higher, who sits down across from you and basically has a philosophical debate with you about your ideas, poses moral questions like, would you fight Hitler? Would you kill someone to save your own life? Then that officer writes up their impression of your conversation and sends it up the chain of command. And each officer in your chain of command votes either yes or no. The process is supposed to happen in about 90 days, but in actual practice, it generally takes about a year. Mine took a year to decide and 18 months for me to finally get my discharge. And it's certainly not a parachute or an eject button from the military by any stretch.
Aidan, how do you reconcile your feelings on the war with other Buddhists who remain in the military?
Yeah, you know, this is something I've given a lot of thought to. And in fact, there was a Buddhist chaplain that my first sergeant met. I didn't meet him, but he spoke to my first sergeant and said, well, you know, Buddhism doesn't forbid participation in the military. And clearly there are Buddhists who hold that view. I mean, the entire nation of Thailand is Buddhist and they have an army. But the thing I would say is that no religion is monolithic and nobody holds a monopoly on interpretation. There are Catholic conscious objectors and there are Catholics serving in the military. And it's really a personal decision and the army recognizes that.
Aidan, do you have any advice for those people in the military that are struggling with the same feelings that you were struggling with, and yet they're not going to be granted conscientious objector status?
Yeah, you know, I recognize that reality, because the truth is conscientious objector status is very class biased. It's for white-collar people, people who've written essays, who've gone to college, and it's very difficult to win it if you don't have that background. But the thing I would say is that there are other options, and I think that there are less objectionable options than being on the front lines. I think being a medic or being in the support jobs may help alleviate some of that conscience. But the other thing I would say is that making a public stand and saying that if you really believe that it's wrong to participate in this in any form, then you have to come out and say it. And whether that means applying for conscientious objector status or being an activist on your personal time, on your off time, following your conscience is the highest freedom.
Someday, Iraq is going to be a part of history. Someday, our troops are going to come home. What are you going to do then with the rest of your life?
You know, that's probably the wisest question I've ever heard asking to veterans, and I think we don't ask it enough. And I can tell you that already I'm trying to move on to do other things with my life. I've woken up since I've come back from Iraq. I've become more activated as a citizen, as a person, and I want to keep that going. I want to go into law. I want to get a degree in law, and I want to run for office. I want to go into politics because I think I have something good to say, and I think I have something good to contribute to civic life. And already I'm trying to move beyond merely being a soldier, merely being a veteran, because I don't want that to be the story of my whole life. I want to have so much more to report and to look back on and to say that I did than merely I spent 1 year in Iraq. And I want to use this as a jumping off point and not as an end point.
Aidan, I have to say, I admire your courageous conscientiousness in the past. I affirm your vision for the future. And Aidan Delgado, I thank you for sharing your story with us on State of Belief.
Thank you. It's been an honor.
Up next, we'll look at a contentious governor's race in Louisiana. That's almost a redundancy, isn't it? And I've got a bone to pick with the state's Democratic Party for how they're running the campaign. I'm Welton Gaddy, and this is State of Belief on Air America Radio. Welcome back to State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy, and we're in Burbank. As Johnny Carson liked to say, beautiful downtown Burbank, though I don't think he was serious when he said that. We came to enjoy the temperate climate of Southern California, but in this instance, we hit a heat wave in late August, but we're still enjoying the people and the area. Speaking of heat wave, things are really heating up this week in the state of Louisiana. As you may recall, that is my home state. That is the state in which is located the church that I pastor. There's a gubernatorial race going on there, and both parties are pulling out all the stops to ensure victory. Now, let me tell you, dirty politics in Louisiana is nothing new. But this past week, the Democratic Party of Louisiana may have taken it a step too far when they put together a television commercial challenging the religious bona fides of Republican candidate Bobby Jindal.
Most Americans believe we should respect one another's religion, but not Bobby Jindal. He wrote articles that insulted thousands of Louisiana Protestants. He has referred to Protestant religions as scandalous, depraved, selfish, and heretical.
Now, come on, people. It's time to change the negative stereotypes of Louisiana politics. This isn't going to do it. Jindal has said that the ads are filled with lies and that he never insulted any branch of the Christian faith. Now, quite frankly, lies are not. What we object to is the use of Jindal's religious writings in the 1990s, before he was an elected official, as a means of appealing to Protestant voters. We cannot say it enough, but we're going to try. The politicization of religion and religious language undermines the electoral process and disrespects the important role that faith plays in Americans' lives. The manipulation of religion has no place in our politics. I've written a letter to the Louisiana Democratic Party asking them to stop airing television ads that address Representative Jindal's Catholic faith and to take down the website jindalonreligion.com. I hope that cooler heads will prevail. And while we're discussing Louisiana, let's not forget that this coming week marks 2 years since Hurricane Katrina slammed into the Gulf Coast. I remember that day as if it were yesterday. On State of Belief, we've devoted several shows to the aftermath of the storm and the difficulties in rebuilding the devastated region. And 2 years later, great steps are still needed to ensure quality housing, schools, and jobs for the poor and vulnerable people of the region who are still waiting for help. Amid the devastation wreaked by Hurricane Katrina, there was a revelation of the bankruptcy of what had been called compassionate conservatism. It is time for us to be conservative and compassionate in addressing the most basic needs of people still hurting. As we head into this anniversary week, let us all remember that although it might not make page one of the newspaper these days, a major American city and its surrounding area have still not recovered from the massive devastation wrought by the storm. Bruce Nolan, religion reporter of the Times-Picayune newspaper in New Orleans, said it best when, in New Orleans, we spoke to him last February.
It's always been difficult for the media to convey the enormity of the damage in New Orleans, and it remains so. If the lower Ninth Ward is the poster boy for what's going on in New Orleans, that's an accurate proxy for what's going on in the rest of the city. And all of us in the city hope that the press, in all of its forms, continues to pay attention to that and understands that the occasional feel-good story, like the Saints, is a relief to a backdrop of continuing struggle and misery. Someone asked Spike Lee in a Monday night game earlier in the year, what's this like? And Spike Lee, to his credit, I think, said, remember, when all of these cheering people leave the stadium this evening, they're going back to their FEMA trailers. And that's the truth. That's the truth.
Please don't forget. Well, that's our show for this week. Remember, we want to know your thoughts on questions about personal faith in the presidential campaigns. Let us know what you think by going to stateofbelief.com, where you can send us an email. Or you can call us at 212-871-8280. That's 212-871-8280. Does it matter to you if a candidate prays? Do you think such questions should be off limits? Do you think they're helpful? Let us know. We want to hear from you. Next week, it's Labor Day weekend, but believe me, we won't be resting. We'll be right here for you during your barbecues and pool parties. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and that's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.